supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hello and welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, filling in for host Mike McGrath. As summer begins to wind down, we decided to look back and listen to some of our most interesting interviews with one more summer special edition of You Bet Your Garden. Joining me is associate producer Brett Rader, who has been working really hard for us this summer.
Hi, Alexis. Can I be honest? I don't want this summer to end. I'm not looking forward to fall.
Oh, come on. Fall is great, especially because the biting insects go away. But you know, not all bugs are bad. Let's listen to Mike's conversation with Dr. Mary Gardner, author of Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. Dr. Gardner gives us a sneak peek into the world of beneficial insects and why they are so important to the health of a garden.
Dr. Gardner, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much.
I have to say that over my time at Organic Gardening Magazine and here on You Bet Your Garden, beneficial insects are us. It is one of our favorite topics. And one thing I keep trying to explain to people is if you get all the good bugs coming to your garden, you really aren't going to have the kind of bad bug problems that people who have who spray insecticides.
That's right. So when you use insecticides, of course, you not only kill the pest insects, but you also harm a lot of non-target insects, including beneficials. And so you end up, if pests recolonize, they're not being that group of beneficial predators and parasitoids that you need to keep them in check. So enhancing your garden as a habitat for these insects can create a more sustainable and manageable level of pest insects throughout the season.
When I give my talks on attracting beneficial insects, obviously number one is just don't use pesticides. I mean, as you point out, they're very detrimental to the beneficial insects, but I don't think they hurt the bad bugs anymore. Sometimes, like, spraying 7 on a stink bug is like giving them a Flintstones vitamin. They just, you know, perk up a little bit.
Well, unfortunately, some pest insects have developed resistance to certain insecticides, so certainly you can see reduced efficacy in cases when you're using pesticides. And typically, our beneficial insects don't have that same level of resistance, so they're going to have more mortality in cases.
A lot of times, people will simply spray because something's moving in their garden. And I can't tell you how many people who have accurately reported to me what a great job they did, and I've identified that they wiped out a cluster of ladybug eggs or green lacewing larvae.
Well, that's true. If you can't identify the pest and beneficials, then it makes it very difficult to be able to scout and to manage your garden for pests. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book about predators and parasitoids, because they are difficult to identify without a resource. We wanted to include a lot of pictures so that people could figure out what these unknowns were before they made a management decision.
Now, I do want to talk about the plantings and other things that we can do in our gardens to bring these creatures in, but I'm going to go out of order in your book, and I'm going to go right to the field guide, because everybody knows ladybugs. If they've been listening to this show, they know about lacewings. And then there's other names I'll throw out there that I honestly think they feel I'm making up. You know, the minute pirate bug. Come on.
It's legit. So the minute pirate bug, as the name suggests, is a tiny insect. It's just a couple millimeters long. It has black and white wing patches, and it's a piercing sucking insect, so it will stab prey with its piercing beak and then suck out the liquid contents.
Some of them look remarkably like things that you couldn't blame people for thinking are pests, the two spotted stink bug, which looks a little bit like a harlequin bug.
It does. The two-spotted stink bug, though, is a really great one to have in the garden because it's a Colorado potato beetle predator.
There you go.
So if you find a stink bug that's has a black body with bright coloration along the edges of the body on your potatoes, definitely let it be, because that's going to be consuming the eggs and larvae of the potato beetle.
I try to make the distinction when people ask about praying mantises in the garden and spiders. I go, well, they're generally good, but they're just basic predators. They will attack anything, including some good bugs and some pollinators. But there is a class that only prey upon pest insects. And in many cases, the pest insect is the only thing that this creature ever gets to eat.
Yeah, so good garden bugs in this book range from highly generalized, like you said, insects that will feed on basically anything that they can catch, to very specialized. And one of the most specialized groups are the parasitoids. So parasitoid wasps typically attack only one type of prey or a small number of different types of prey.
It is my understanding when, and again, this was something I learned recently, you know, we have the marmorated stink bug now that has exploded on the scene and is causing a lot of mischief on my tomatoes and peach trees and things like that. And then, of course, overwintering in people's homes. And we had a researcher, an entomologist on the show, explain that one of these miniature wasps, and again, we need to remind people that these wasps, some of them are so small, they're the size of the period at the end of a sentence in a newspaper. These are not wasps that can impact us in any way. But there was a specific predatory wasp from, I believe, Korea that only preys on this version of the stink bug.
Yes, yeah, so that's a form of importation biological control. So what happens a lot with these invasive pest insects is that when they're introduced accidentally into a new area, they come without their predators, without their pathogens, without anything that's going to control their abundance. And so we see this huge population increase, as we have with the brown marmorated stink bug. And so I think in that case, researchers are looking at introducing a parasitoid wasp as a means to reduce the abundance of the stink bug here in the U.S. With wasp parasitoids, they have what looks like a stinger, but is actually an ovipositor or egg-laying organ. And so that ovipositor allows them to sting their prey and deposit an egg within it. Some wasps or flies will lay their eggs on their prey, and then the larvae will hatch from those eggs and enter the insect. And some parasitoids even lay their eggs directly on plant material, hoping that their host will consume the eggs during feeding, and some of the undamaged eggs then hatch once they're inside the pest. Once the eggs hatch, one or more larvae will emerge per pest, and those larvae will consume the pest from the inside out in an alien-like way, and then they will pupate either inside the host or outside, sometimes on it, and then emerge as adults.
Let's talk about habitat. One thing that I don't talk about on the show nearly as much as I should are ground beetles. And again, this is an insect that people look at and they're probably a little scared of. But ground beetles, I've been led to believe, are second only to toads in the number of things they can consume at ground level.
Oh, absolutely. Ground beetles are very common and they're very important in garden habitats. Ground beetles can range from pretty tiny, just a few millimeters, up to a couple of centimeters in total size. So they're very large to very small. Most are either black or brown and shiny or metallic. And they oftentimes have wing covers or elytra that have striations or indentations that run over the length of them. And although they're ground beetles, there are species that climb trees or plants looking for their pests, but most of them are going to be found on the soil surface or in mulch, and the larvae are found a little bit below ground, feeding below ground on pests.
Do they prey on slugs, or do they just prey on soft-bodied insects?
Their food varies a little bit between the species, but there are species that feed on snails and slugs, caterpillars, other beetle larvae, fly larvae, all sorts of different insect pests. Also, some species eat weed seeds.
Oh, excellent.
I need more of those in my own garden.
Yeah, yeah. Let's start breeding the weed-eating beetle and let it go. And again, as you said, to have ground beetles around, just have places for them to hide.
Yes, there's all sorts of habitat management strategies that a gardener can take to increase the abundance of beneficial insects. So this can range from things like making insectary plantings or adding mulch or other ground cover to create a more complex habitat for ground-dwelling species, influencing how you manage your lawn and allowing for some flowering plants within a lawn is a great way, providing overwintering and shelter resources. So there's many steps that we can take.
But you also lead the book off with exactly what I think people want to know. You know, just cut to the chase. Tell me what to plant. And you have what you call the sweet seven right up front. I've always been told dill is like the poster child for attracting beneficial insects to your garden.
Oh, if you observe dill for a couple of minutes, you'll see that it's teeming with lots of different predatory insects and parasitoids feeding on pollen and nectar.
Yeah, I always tell people grow twice as much and let the other half go to flower.
Yeah, that's a great strategy. You could create an edge planting of something like dill and coriander and allow it to bolt, and then keep other plantings at bay so that, you know, you can continue to harvest those. But I know my cilantro always bolts, and I think people's tendency is to take it out, but it's really an attractive plant for beneficial insects, so something to keep around. Not everyone realizes how many insects feed on pollen and nectar. So we think about bees doing that, but lady beetles, spiders, all sorts of predators feed on these resources and they need them to survive.
All right. The name of the book is Good Garden Bugs, Everything You Need to Know About Beneficial Predatory Insects. The author is Dr. Mary Gardner. Mary, Dr. Gardner, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that you're listening to a special summertime edition of You Bet Your Garden, featuring some of our most interesting interviews from past shows, selected and introduced by our producer Alexis Landis and production associate Brett Rader. Coming up next, important pruning advice, the most amazing wasp of all, and a brand new poison ivy interview. I'm playing hooky down the shore, Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm producer Alexis Landis, assisting hardworking, vacationing, host Mike McGrath by introducing some of our favorite interviews from the last couple of years. Helping me do this is associate producer Brett Rader. Hey, Brett.
Hi, Alexis.
Coming up, you'll hear Mike's fascinating conversation with author Mike Shanahan, who wrote Gods, Wasps, and Stranglers, a book that shows not only the profound effect fig trees have had on civilization, but the connection between fig trees and tiny wasps.
Now, I know our listeners call in about their figs all the time, but what could wasps possibly have to do with figs?
You know, Brett, I'm going to have to let the two Mikes tell you all about it. I have to say, though, I've worked on this show for 8 years, and this is one of my favorite interviews. It's truly amazing. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Okay, you've sold me. Let's listen.
Mike Shanahan, Welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. I can't tell you the last time I enjoyed a book as much as I've enjoyed God's Wasps and Stranglers.
Wow, thank you.
What a great title, by the way. So let's get started in reverse order. I am fascinated with the strangler fig. Now, this is not one specific species, right? This is several species in the genus Ficus?
That's right. Dozens of species are loosely called strangler figs, and they strangle in different ways. Some of them are what botanists would call true stranglers, and some are what people sometimes call banyans.
Right. So what I got from this is in the rainforest or wherever, a monkey or a bird will eat a fig. It'll poop out the seeds up in the canopy. The seed will lodge in like a crevice in the nook of a tree, in the crotch of a tree, something like that. And then what grows out of it, I guess, would at first be termed an epiphyte because it's not taking nutrition from the tree. But then it does something epiphytes otherwise never do that I've never heard of, right? Which is send down these arms and legs.
That's right, exactly. They send down their roots down the host tree until they reach the ground. And once they reach the ground, that's when everything really starts to take off. And they have the benefits of light in the canopy, but they also have the benefits of water and nutrients from the soil of the forest floor.
And these stranglers are not content to have a single arm or a leg.
That's right. Well, some of them will keep sending more of these roots down, and as they send them down, they connect with each other, they join and merge and split apart again, so they create this spectacle that looks like molten wax. And as they do this, they build a structure around their host tree, which indeed can die away, leaving a hollow core. And there you have a beautiful thing in the forest that is now a freestanding tree on its own, but it started off in life as a strangler and removed its host from the ecosystem.
The host tree would probably never have lived as long as the strangler, right?
Well, some of the host trees are very big, long-lived trees, and some of the strangler figs never quite go all the way and encase their host. So they have a permanent existence together. But others, they don't live long enough to outsee the fig, so the fig ends up living on its own and can itself be much bigger than the host was.
Am I correct in that one of the trees, the strangler trees you discuss, one that Alexander the Great found, had gotten so massive that 10,000 people could stand under it?
Well, that's what they said at the time, and the contemporary reports that Alexander's men made wrote about this huge tree, and for a long time people in the West thought this was a pure exaggeration and nonsense, but actually there is a tree in southern India which is one of the same species. It's called Ficus bengalensis, the banyan tree, and 20,000 people can shelter beneath that tree. It's so huge.
So it's not all open space underneath, right? There'd be all these walls coming down and columns?
Well, the banyan's a special kind of strangler fig, and what it does, as its branches grow out, they drop down vertical roots that descend to the ground, and when they reach the ground, they thicken and form what look like tree trunks. So a banyan itself can look like a small forest with thousands of trees in it, but it's actually just one tree with all of these false trunks that are supporting the huge branches. And as the branches grow, they send out more and more of these false trunks, so it can keep expanding.
And there's many different types of figs, not just the quote-unquote edible figs that we're most used to. What kind of figs are we going to see in these strangler trees?
Well, as you say, there are many types of figs. There are at least 750 and maybe as many as 900 different species of figs, and that's a phenomenal diversity. And not only are they many in number, they're hugely varied. The strangler figs are just one group. They tend to produce figs that are red or orange or black and that are eaten by birds and monkeys and other animals that come in the daytime, as well as fruit bats at nighttime. But their figs don't really taste very nice. They're nothing like the big juicy ones you get in the grocery store. They're far less sweet. They're much more fibrous. They might do well for a gibbon or for a parrot, but for us, they're not really good fare.
Now, the book is Gods, Wasps, and Stranglers. So let's get right to the gods. The Buddha is said to have become the Buddha meditating underneath a fig tree.
That's right. The fig tree in that case is a species called Ficus religiosa, the sacred fig. And although the Buddha has perhaps made this the most famous of the species of fig trees and a species that has been spread around the world where it adorns Buddhist temples everywhere, it's the Buddha's enlightenment was only one link in a long, long chain that connects this species to human history and prehistory. It's also very important in Hinduism, in Jainism, and in the distant religions that predated Hinduism, way back when the Vedic people were living in cities in the Indus Valley.
It almost seems like there is no organized religion that the fig tree was not central to, in the same way that the oak is considered the tree of civilization because it helped build so many things. The fig seems to be the nurturing tree of humanity.
Well, certainly there's fig trees appear in Christianity and in Islam and in Judaism, in Hinduism and Buddhism. But I think more interestingly, they also appear in many of the far older traditions that are spread all across the tropics among people who live in and close to forests. And this is in South America, in Africa, in Asia. All over the world, you find people have got traditions that say don't cut down fig trees because they're important. They tell stories that gods and spirits reside in the branches of the fig trees. And they have special rituals and taboos that relate to these trees as well.
And don't we go back as far as Genesis, Adam and Eve? This is, many people postulate that the forbidden fruit, the tree of knowledge.
That's right. That's what Michelangelo portrayed when he painted the scene on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. It's what people in the Middle East and in Southern Europe were depicting when they drew pictures of this early scene. It's latterly, I think, the Western Europeans have been told it was an apple. The Bible, of course, doesn't actually say what it is, but the Bible does mention in that scene a fig tree. It's the fig tree that gave Adam and Eve their clothes. And it's the only tree mentioned by name in the Garden of Eden.
So, I mean, and you go into great depth in your book about all of these backgrounds where the fig tree is essential to all these religions. One of the things that fascinated me the most, and I might be getting this wrong, so you'll correct me, but at one point, the tree under which Siddhartha became the Buddha, a cutting was taken from it, and it made like the most amazing journey of all time?
That's right. There was several years after the Buddha's death, the emperor of the time, Ashoka, was so taken by Buddhism, he converted and became a practicing Buddhist and spread it across the land as the religion of what is now India. And he decided one day to spread his message of peace to the king of Sri Lanka. So he chopped off a branch of the Buddha's tree of enlightenment and sent it on a very long journey over the mountains and down the Ganges River to the sea. It was carried in a vast vase made of solid gold whose rim was as thick as an elephant's trunk. And he waved it off, and his daughter and his son carried it to Sri Lanka, where the king received it, took it inland and placed it in his capital. And people say that the same tree is growing there now. So this is reputed to be the tree with the longest history and a known planting date on the planet, more than 2,200 years old.
And there's also the circle became fully closed when a cutting from this tree went back to the original, it's called the Bodhi tree, right? The tree that the Buddha found enlightenment under?
That's right, the Bodhi tree. So a cutting from the one in Sri Lanka went back a few years ago, back to the site of the Buddha's enlightenment, because the original tree there had long since passed away. But that's the circle complete, more than 3,600 miles, I believe.
It all comes down to these massive trees that may be among the biggest living things on the planet, that may be among the oldest living things on the planet, that may be the most sacred plants on the planet. They all depend on one specific type of tiny little wasp that does some of the craziest stuff in nature.
That's right. Every fig species has a very tight relationship with specific wasp species, and the wasps need the fig trees in order to breed, and the figs need the wasps in order to breed. It's a combination of love interests. And the way it works is this: the fig itself is not a fruit. It's a hollow ball containing flowers, and those flowers are the only place that the fig wasp can lay its eggs.
And you say in your book, one of the things that that kind of blew me away is you can work in botany all your life. You can live 300 years, and you've never seen a fig in flower.
That's right. You never see flowers on a fig tree because they're hidden away inside the figs. This mystery has endured for a long time, and lots of people thought that figs didn't have flowers up until fairly recently in the history of botany.
So we have this capsule with unpollinated flowers that the tree has produced. And then we have this female wasp, because the women always do all the work in all parts of the world. And does this female wasp actually eat its way into the fig? Does she have to bore in?
No, well, first she has to find the right species of fig, and she does that by detecting a smell that the fig emits at the right time. And then she finds a tiny hole at the bottom of the fig, at the base of the fig, and she forces her way into that little hole. And as she does, she finds herself in a little tube, a little column so tight that it wrenches the wings from her back and the antennae from her head. And she plows on forward until she's in the darkness, and then she can start to lay eggs in the flowers within the fig. And she also pollinates these flowers because she's brought with her pollen from the fig in which she was born.
And then I'm presuming that the larvae that hatch from her eggs will not destroy the now pollinated fig?
Well, in most species that we're talking about, the strangler figs and others, what happens is she will lay her eggs in some of the flowers, but not others, because she can't quite reach her ovipositor in, her egg-laying tube. She can't quite reach it all the way down. So some of the ones that she pollinates will turn into seeds, and some of the ones she pollinates will turn into baby wasps.
Which the next round of figs needs.
Exactly. So it's in the fig's interests to let her have some of the flowers. That's how it pays the pollinator.
And you tell a terrible tale. Places where droughts have forced the figs not to produce any capsules for years, and then the wasps die out. But then that's when you realize how many creatures in this rainforest or whatever type of habitat it is depend on the figs, because you have massive population losses of monkeys and birds and bats, right?
That's right. The interesting thing about figs is that they are produced year-round in a tropical forest. They have to, because the wasps only live for a couple of days, and so they always need to find some figs in which they can lay their eggs. So the figs are always being produced year-round. Every day in the forest, there'll be ripe figs for the animals to eat as well, because the flip side of that is that there's always going to be some pollinated figs that are producing seeds. And so many of the animals in a typical rainforest will eat figs. Many depend on them, and many of them depend on them only when other foods aren't available, which is always at some point of the year. They've helped to sustain the forests that are all around us. They keep alive thousands of species of animals, and through them, many tens of thousands of species of plants and microbes and bugs and other insects. They really are central to so many parts of the web of life. And interestingly, they've probably also had a huge impact on the evolution of our species. They've played a role in feeding us long, long, long ago. And what's interesting to me now is that they're very useful tools for helping to repair forests that have been damaged either through logging or mining or other sorts of activities.
Mike, I have a feeling that just as my mind has been blown by your book, people who are growing backyard figs and having great success in warm areas and struggling to protect them in the north are going to be exposed to a world that they're never going to look at their figs in the same way again. Your book is absolutely wonderful and engaging. I'm reading it now for the second time, which is 1.5 times more than I read most books. The book is God's Wasps and Stranglers. The author is Mike Shanahan. It is brand new from Chelsea Green Publishing. Mike was kind enough to speak with us today from the southeast coast of England. Mike, I wish you great success with the book, but more than anything, I'm not quite sure I've said this to an author before. Thank you so much for writing it.
Thank you, and thank you for reading it. I'm glad you're one of the first people in the world to read it. And I'm sure that many people will find this to be really fascinating. It's my mission to tell everybody about these trees that have entranced me so much over the years.
It's my book of the year. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Ludington Library in Lower Merion on Wednesday evening, October 4th, at the Lower Makefield Township Building on Saturday, October 28th. And I'll be proud to deliver the keynote address at the Phipps Conservatory and Botanic Gardens in Pittsburgh during their annual Native Plant and Sustainability Conference on Saturday, October 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with important info about pruning and poison ivy. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 141st year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. And we're in the stretch now. That's our engineer's favorite part, of course. I'm producer Alexis Landis having a little fun while we look back at some of our most engaging interviews during this summer special. Getting into trouble with me is my fearless co-host, associate producer Brett Rader. Coming up, Mike talks with one of my favorite repeat guests, Umar Mica, who is a poison ivy horticulturalist.
And if that's not enough, a little later in the show, we're going to put down our pruners and listen to some advice from Mike about pruning our precious plants. But that's a lot to get done. First, let's hear about poison ivy.
Umar, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being had, Umar. Let's start by going over the basics, because we really can't talk about this enough. I think you and I agree that there's really only one way to get poison ivy off of a property, and it's physical removal. Why don't people understand that herbicides are not going to solve the problem? They may look like they do, but they don't.
They don't understand the scope of the size and weight of the poison ivy plant.
And they don't understand that the herbicide just, quote, kills the plant. It doesn't deactivate the resin that people react to.
It doesn't deactivate the resin. It partially kills the plant. And the parts that are not killed are broken into pieces. It's like as if you have a mirror. It's one mirror, like one poison ivy plant. But if you break that mirror into 1,000 pieces, you have 1,000 pieces of poison ivy to pick up. And that's what the herbicide does to it.
And one of my greatest fears with people using herbicides on poison ivy is now they're not being cautious anymore. Now it looks harmless. In my mind, poison ivy that's all browned and shriveled is much more dangerous than the green plant, which is like sending out a signal to people.
Okay, I'll go for that.
Now, you have a staff, you have a crew, and you go out to a home. You've been called. They have extensive poison ivy. They've never known exactly what to do with it. As you've told me in the past, you have been faced not with just an afternoon pulling plants out of the ground. You've been faced with real serious logistical problems and tonnage at the end of the day.
Yes, we dug one plant last year, one female poison ivy plant, 25 years old, 930 pounds. It was attached to a choke cherry tree. It had killed it.
Does that make it easier for you? Did you also take down the choke cherry?
In this case, we did. It was up on a second tree, which we were able to save.
Okay. In the past, and you seem to have approved of this, I tell people when they have small amounts of poison ivy to wet the soil, get a whole bunch of plastic bags from the supermarket or the mall, slip a bag on each hand, pull the plants up, put bags and all in the trash, and keep using fresh bags and do that till you're done with poison ivy. So you're not getting it on gloves, your clothing, or anything like that. But trees are the wild card, and that's often the habit of poison ivy, to develop these really hairy, gigantic vines going up the side of a tree.
Right, and those big vines have a component that grows up a tree and also grows along the ground. If you're pulling poison ivy with bags on your hand, which is fine, and those plants are first year, second year, or third year plants, you'll get them completely out. But if they're connected to large plants which are growing up trees, then that's a whole different story.
You're right, and in my memory, it doesn't need the trees. When I bought my property, I had a very different experience pulling poison ivy. I had already figured out what to do from gardening for years and getting tired of getting it on my gloves and then getting it every time I went out to garden. But the first vines I pulled up at my new home that apparently had been growing for years and years, when I pulled really slowly from wet soil, the roots would travel 12, 20 feet sometimes. It would come up like an old telegraph line from the ground. They weren't deep, but you would wind up with like a coil of rope, like a lasso around your hand.
Right. Now, I call those post-mature plants. So they started out with a component of a poison ivy growing up a tree. That growing up a tree component only you'll live for about 40, 50 years at the most. Fungus kills that, but what's growing in the ground can live indefinitely. So I think, Mike, when you came into your property, the vertical component had either already died or it was a genetic form which was just growing on the ground.
Right. They seem to be like, I would call it third-year plants, second-year plants or something like that. But the root system, you could make a long-distance call to Delaware from my house. It was ridiculous.
That's right. Yeah, those long runners.
So we get to a house, and there's this magnificent old oak tree or a sugar maple or an ash tree that hasn't been hit by the borers, and it's got this monster vine going up the side. It seems an impossible task. What I've told people in the past is to use a bow saw to gently try to sever the vine without injuring the bark too much and then wait for the uppermost growth of the plant to die. But I'm not seeing that alien-like body coming off the trunk of the tree really easy. What do you do? How do you do this?
The vertical component really doesn't need to come off the tree. What we usually do is we'll cut that up to a height of 8 or 10 feet
mm-hmm.
out of the way and out of the view. That will hang up there for some years.
You're saying you'll cut it off at ground level.
Yes.
And then you'll remove it from the tree up to the point where most humans are going to lean against the tree or touch it or see it.
Yes. And then that,
and then you'll leave maybe 30 feet at the top of the tree because people aren't going to encounter that.
Most clients, they'll want it done that way. And then in the rain and in the cold weather, the wet weather, that resin becomes inactive in the moisture.
Right. The best, I forgot to say that, the best time to pull poison ivy is in the rain. You got a helper.
Mm-hmm. Long term, people say, well, how long will that resin stay active? It'll stay active for a while, but it will become inactive by the rain.
Now, I'm presuming a component of this is there's a whole mess of leaves up in the tree that are mimicking the tree leaves. They come out, right?
Yes, they'll fall out.
Or do you pull them down?
No, we don't necessarily pull them down, and especially if they're not in a place that's going to bother in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
But if they are in a place that is like over a driveway or something, then we'll try to get down as much as possible.
Right, because once it gets up into the tree, it's not really clinging anymore. It's just hanging loose, right?
No, it's pushing very hard against that tree. It's growing to get into the sunlight, but the liana, the vine itself, is actually pushing against a tree. It's holding itself by pressure against a tree.
Let's say we've got 30 feet that you have not removed of this. And you have a name for the component, the big hairy part that attaches to the tree?
Yeah, generally speaking, that type of a woody vine growth is called a liana.
Let's say you clean out the top of the tree, just to make my scenario
right.
The way I want it. And you've taken off the bottom 10 feet so nobody
right.
can get in. But we've still got 30 feet of liana in there.
Yeah.
In the summertime, will she become active again, even though the roots have been severed? Will the heat activate the resin stored inside? Because you say in the winter, the vine is much less active because of the cooler temperatures. I'm just wondering that even though it's severed, because you cut a poison ivy plant and you let it lay on the ground, that plant is still going to be able to give people the allergenic rash for X number of years, right?
Truthfully, there's no experimentation on that. The scientific facts of poison ivy are absolutely not known. And there is somebody working on it at the Gillesco Lab at Virginia Tech, and he has a project called the Itchy Project
of course, yeah.
that he's working on to try to get some of the basic science of this done.
Full disclosure, over the years, you have sometimes purchased local underwriting on the show to tell gardeners about your service. Obviously, I had you on before you were able to do that, and I'll have you on every once in a while just because this is so important a topic. And there doesn't seem to be anybody else out there doing what you're saying, but you are highly allergic, right? You're highly reactive.
Yeah, I have to be careful.
When's the last time you got burned, Umar?
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah, what'd you get?
Yeah, I got enough that the Zanfell soap took care of it in a day or two.
I would think you would agree with me to prevent its touching you or to wash that area immediately is going to be more effective than anything that you can do after the blisters appear, after the rash
no,
appears.
No, absolutely. More effective and much more cost effective. A grease cutting soap. Shampoo is a grease cutting soap that everybody has in their house. You could clean up after gardening with shampoo.
Okay.
You could clean up with a dishwashing soap, which is grease cutting. That is going to help to knock that and just mechanically remove the poison ivy resin.
I like that. And then there's no bar of soap either.
No, no bar of soap. No, just squeeze it.
Then everything is just being washed
mm-hmm.
away. I like
yeah.
that a lot.
Yeah.
So if you have your property cleared of poison ivy, springtime is your time to take care of this before it gets out of control.
Right. We want to check for seedlings from late May through September. Those little tiny seedlings, they can just be plucked out.
It makes sense. You've got young plants that have not developed a lot of resin yet. They're easy to pull out of wet soil. You can save yourself a lot of misery down the line.
Exactly. That's why I'm really glad we're talking about that. This is what this is all about. Not letting poison ivy send family members to the doctor in the hospital, steal our vacation time from us. A lot of people can't go into work if their arms are broken out.
Yeah,
so
no.
So if we can just do a little preventive gardening, it saves a lot of heartache.
Oh, right. Always a pleasure, Umar. We've been talking with Umar Mika, the poison ivy horticulturalist. You can find out more about him and his business at the website idontwantpoisonivy.com. Umar, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Mike.
As promised, it's time for the question of the week, pruning trees in the summertime. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, get us started by reading the first of this week's trio of tree questions.
I'd be happy to. Marcus in Clarksville, Tennessee writes, "When is the best time to trim a magnolia tree? I have one whose branches are drooping down to the ground and the tree's profile is uneven. Can it be trimmed without hurting it?"
Well, it really pays to know your species here. There are a number of different types of magnolia. Some are evergreen, some are deciduous, and their bloom times can vary quite a bit. The general advice is to prune the deciduous types, you know, the ones that drop their leaves in winter right after their flowers fade in the spring. And to prune evergreen types, like the hugely popular grandiflora, the native southern magnolia, before new growth begins in the spring.
But I think I hear a big but in your voice.
Really? Does this question make my voice look big? Okay. But every source also warns that you shouldn't prune them unless you absolutely have to, especially older trees. Our pruning guru, Lee Reich, warns that magnolias heal very slowly after pruning, and that you should always try and shape them while they're still young. The Southern Living Garden book echoes those warnings, especially with the deciduous types, but they also leave the door open for some pruning to correct shape and remove those very low branches.
So what's your advice?
Figure out exactly what kind of magnolia you have. Do the absolute least to it you can live with. Do that at the best possible time of year for that species, and then see how the tree responds before you do it again. Because if you just go whacking away at these plants when you feel like it, you could end up minus a magnolia.
Well, we also heard from Bruce in Gaithersburg, who writes, "I've had my American hornbeam for about 4 or 5 years, and it was doing great until this year, when a lot of the top branches didn't green up. Should I leave it alone or prune out the dead branches?"
Well, Bruce sent us a picture of his hornbeam, an excellent and underutilized landscape tree that shows good growth down low, but dead branches sticking out of the top. The basic answer here is easy. You should always remove dead, diseased, or severely damaged branches as soon as you see them. Seasonal pruning rules do not apply to dead wood. So when you do this, remove the entire affected branch in sections if the branch is long and heavy, going all the way back to the tree, but leaving the branch collar, that round donut-shaped section where the branch meets the trunk, attached to the tree. Don't cut flush to the trunk, and don't seal the pruning cuts with anything. These trees don't need it.
I hear another butt coming.
Well, it's better than seeing it coming. Anyway, yes, I was suspicious, and so I asked Bruce to send us a picture of the base of the tree.
Oh no, not another case of volcano mulching.
Chips the color of a Burger King mounded up against the bottom 6 inches of the trunk of this poor tree. I told Bruce to scrape it all away, expose the root flare of the tree, and just hope that the bark hasn't been rotted or eaten away in a complete circle.
Oh, well, yeah, then there's no hope.
Nah, and that'd be a real shame. These hornbeams are great trees.
We finish up with Dave, just outside of Dover, Delaware. He writes, "I have 14 assorted fruit trees, which you and your friend Lee Reich have educated me to prune during dormancy, which I do every year. However, my plum, apple, and apricot trees have since grown significantly, and I'm seeing disease that I feel certain is being caused by the density of the biomass and resulting bad airflow. What should I do if I vigorously prune in the winter but still have dramatic growth in the spring and summer? I know that pruning at the end of summer or in the fall can do a lot of harm, but can I prune in early to mid-summer to open things up?
We should add here that Dave's email went on in length and that his trees are mulched with compost, his lawn is organic, there's plenty of room between his trees, and he sprays them with Surround, the same clay spray I use to protect my peaches, so he has really tried to prevent these kinds of problems.
So no buts here. He's doing all the basic things correctly. Then what's the answer?
Prune and prune again.
Nah, really?
Yep. And I wouldn't know this if I hadn't planted my own peach trees years ago. I wait until mine are flowering, and then I prune them. And when I do, I really open them up to try to get great internal airflow. The week after that, I worry I pruned them too much. By the next week, I'm not worried anymore. And then some years, the new growth is so lush, I have to prune them again. I probably wind up double pruning every second or third year.
I'm really surprised to hear you say this.
I was surprised when the first time I had to do it, but airflow really is everything with fruit trees. Well, that sure was some interesting information about why you should be putting those pruners down now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to assault my azaleas if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can still call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, 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 please include your location. Oh, we so much want to know where you are when you ask a question. Please, please, please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where nobody cares where you live, but where you will find the answers to all those questions you were going to ask us, as well as audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Rich Banowitz and Larissa Sapko keep our website well pruned. Beneficial Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Fig-loving Al Banks is our editor. Our associate producer of Poison Ivy is Brett Rader. I'm continuing to enjoy my first real break in 18 years, Mike McGrath. But I'll be back. Wait, no. Over here, waiter. The mojito is coming over here, not to them. No, over here. Yes, thank you. Thank you. More mint, okay? I'll see you guys next week, okay? Over here. Want more native plants in your landscape, but you aren't sure exactly which ones are right for you? I'm Mike McGrath, and on a very special edition of You Bet Your Garden, you're going to go on a walk with me down lanes and lanes of native plants while we explore which ones will give you the most benefit.